welcome to Observations, the program that has been dedicated to walking folks who are interested through the pages of Observations for Our Time. Observations for Our Time is now in two volumes. The first volume is completed. It will soon be available for purchase. It is available in its entirety at a number of websites for free, and even the printed version is as cheap as it can be offered. I get no royalty of any kind from the sale of the book, nor does anybody associated with the printing of the book. So it is Yahweh's message we're trying to convey, and it would be inappropriate for us to profit from it. Kirk has devoted even his time and artwork to creating images for the cover of the book. We are currently in Chapter 10 of Volume 1. Volume 2 is still underway. I think that there's another couple of chapters, maybe three chapters to add to Volume 2, and it will be done. And then Kirk will be deciding whether we press ahead with Yeshayah, Isaiah, or turn in a different direction. Like, for example, I'd love to really delve into Zechariah again from beginning to end, because it's so pertinent in terms of what's going to happen in our immediate future. Ezekiel would be another one that speaks about what the world will soon endure. But there's a lot to be said, too, in Yeshayah. But, you know, if I were just to continue to translate and comment on Yeshayah, well, there's more than 10 years of work there.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not a matter of which way to go. And you know, and since you mentioned break, you know, I've thought a lot about Dode and the fact that Dode didn't spend 24/7 writing insights about his relationship with or understanding of Yahweh. You know, it's one of the things that made him an effective communicator to us beyond him having the world's best relationship with Yahweh and probably having the most brilliant mind that of anyone who's ever lived and clearly being the most articulate man of all time, is that everything he wrote was punctuated by his life. It was interspersed within his life. It wasn't written in this void of, I'm in this perfect place and writing about these perfect insights. No, it was raw. It was real.
No, he lived it.
Yeah, it was raw and it was real. And it was woven into his life. And I think that's what makes it so poignant. And, you know, if you look at the first, like, three or four books that I wrote, I guess you can count it as seven books, really, in Yada Yah, because the seven volumes and the five completed volumes of An Introduction to God and Questioning Paul and the like. Until we got to Observations for Our Time, Kirk, I had really left myself out of this. Like, I left myself so out of it that I wrote it under, you know, the pen name Yada, and introduced every book by saying I'm an irrelevant character.
Mm-hmm.
That's not the style of Dode's letters.
No.
And that's not the format that I ended up adopting for Observations for Our Time. It's really personal.
Yeah. It's very obvious, yeah.
It is. It's really personal. Like, there's whole chapters I say, you know, this is my life. This is why I'm here. And so, I changed the approach because the material
dictates that.
Dictated it, yeah. Yeah. And initially I was really uncomfortable with it. And I became really more uncomfortable with it when we started dealing with the choter, that stem, the insignificant tendril, and the neck, the message that Yahweh is lifting up. So it went from, yeah, this is a little uncomfortable, really uncomfortable. But I think that a lot of what Dode wrote was uncomfortable for him. Now, Kirk, we're not comparing. what he wrote to what I wrote. He was writing the inspired word of Yahweh, and all I'm doing is translating what Yahweh communicated through him and the likes of Moshe and Yashayah, and say, I think this is the most accurate and complete translation I can provide. This is what these words mean. Here are some thoughts on how I came to these conclusions. And oh, by the way, here's some insights that I think can be derived from them. And that's a far cry from what they did. But, you know, nonetheless, it's become personal.
Well, on the plus side, there's, I was thinking about this, it's really not a rabbi or a priest or a preacher or a theologian. From everything I've studied, throughout time, I think, really, that could honestly find fault or debate these translations. I mean, you just can't. I mean, unless you just take the superficial.
You can. Practice. Like there is a somewhere online, somebody pointed out somebody who had demeaned questioning Paul. Mm-hmm. Poor scholarship. You know, for example, their first complaint was that I said that Paul wrote half the Christian New Testament. And I think what I actually said was that half of the Christian New Testament can be attributed to Paul.
Well,
because you have Paul's 13 letters, and plus his 13 letters, you have Hebrews that was written by one of his attachés, certainly one of his followers, and Luke and Acts were both written by Paul's promoter, and historian. So, if you look at
no story without Paul.
There really is no story. The Christian New Testament.
It's about Paul.
Yeah, it's about Paul, man. That's just what that's just the truth. And so you put that all together, and that's about half of the Christian New Testament. So their criticism was taking what I said out of context, misapplying it, and creating a false impression. Mm-hmm. And of course, I wouldn't go and raise the flag and say, boy, my translations of the Greek are the best that have ever been done. That just, I would never go that.
You really translate.
And by the way, I don't even care, nor am I attempting to do that. All I did in that book is I made certain that there were at least four traditional translations, New Living Translation, which is a paraphrase, the King James, which is just the one that most people believe, the New American Standard, because it's supposedly literal. And I had those. I think there's one more. Plus, I know what the other one was. I had one that was the most literal translation, one of those that comes as part of an interlinear, where they try to put the most direct translation of each word in the order that the words appear in the text. So that, you know, the niceties of flow are eliminated, and it just, here's what the words say. And so I included that along with my translation, so you could choose between the five of them and compare and contrast them. So because of that, my lack of scholarship in Greek is not much of a problem, although I will say that I think that my Greek translations are still better than any of the others that have been offered there. They're certainly more open and complete and consistent and accurate and well explained. You know, it's
what your critics are saying is I can't deal with facts.
I don't like where the facts lead.
Sorry, don't throw facts at me and confuse me.
Yeah, I don't like where the facts lead. Now, what's interesting, though, is that I don't think I've had anyone reject yada yada, an introduction to God, even questioning Paul, or any of these things based upon my Hebrew translations. I think that the only person who has been critical of my Hebrew translations is me. And you think I would have rewritten yada yada seven times if I was impressed by my own translations? I've been the person that's been most critical of my translations and the most encouraging of others to check them and improve them and challenge them. So
know, that's,
you know. So it's, yeah, and it's, and because the whole process is so much fun to do. But, you know, as I said, Doe did take some time. I, you know, I've had a few bumps in the road here recently, and, you know, I may take a little time, too. It's one of the nice things about working with Yahweh.
Mm-hmm.
He's not demanding.
No.
You do what you do because it's fun to do it. And he realizes that we aren't machines, and that that a break now and then is just okay.
Got to recharge. Yeah,
it's not a problem. But I'm still committed to getting these next few chapters done so we can get Volume 2 published and completed. Going to do that. And then,
are you about 21 now or 22?
Well, you know, it's I broke it into two volumes. So there's chapters, I think it's 1 to 11 in Volume 1. And I think I'm on chapter, 11 of Volume 2. So I think it's, if you're counting total chapters, it's 22. But, you know, Kirk, I'm a little verbose. So we're a standard literary chapter is supposed to average right around 24 pages with it's supposed to be a little more than 12 and less than 36 and average around 24. I've been known to have 200 page chapters.
Yeah.
And they probably average somewhere in the mid 100 to 125 range. So
well, most of the people that read it don't put it down. They really get sad at the end of the book when they say, "Wow, that was over."
Yeah, but you know, my view is that that the second time you go through the material,
it is far more
inspiring than the first time, and the third time you go through it, it's far more inspiring still. You know, one of the things that we have done, Kirk, I think from the beginning, even in Observations for Our Time, and you know, I'm willing to admit my translations are better now than they were 5 years ago, and they're much better than they were 10 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
So as I go through and I retranslate things, or I translate them the first time, and Observations for Our Time, and write them down, and then write down all the insights. You know, how did I come up with this word? Why? You know, what are your options regarding it? What are the potential conclusions? You know, one of the things that's interesting about our review of these books in the audio format is that unless it's something specific like that whole historical analysis of the text of the Christian New Testament, I don't read anything. The only thing we read is the translation itself, and then you look at your research on the words. I look at the words that are in the translation itself, but we never read any of the commentary.
No, I find I forgot there's a commentary button on some of the stuff.
Yeah, pages and pages of it.
I've gone. I said, you know, this is so Christianized, I can't stand it. You got it.
Oh, yeah. What I'm talking about is that is that the translations themselves are interspersed in commentary and insights.
Yes.
You know, for every verse, if you use that term or statement from Yahweh, like we're going to go into 15:1, there are typically 10, maybe on average, paragraphs that I'll write about how I came to that translation, or how we dealt with some of these words, or what some of the moods or stems represent in it, or how this relates to something else, or what it means to our lives, or how we apply it. All of that stuff. The 10 statements that are in the book relative to the passage that we're reading, we don't ever read as part of this program.
No.
That's so all of our insights are extemporaneous based upon what the passage itself teaches us.
Yeah.
That's why I think that the audio, rather than being just a way to listen to the book as opposed to read the book, all it really does is amplify what we've learned by making these translations. I had a friend that was listening to our show. I don't know if it was this week or last week. And we had a conversation, Kirk, about the written word versus the spoken word.
Right.
And what he wrote was really simple. He said, the written word inspires the mind. The spoken word, the heart. The spoken word is the stuff of emotion, and the written word is the stuff of thought.
Well, you know, as a writer, and the one thing about the spoken word is it inspires you to want to read the text. I mean, that was what happened to us. That's how we found you, was on a, or Terry found you originally on the radio talking about it, and it was so exciting to hear that it inspired us to go look at it in depth and analyze it. You can't analyze my memory, even when I was really good at memory. I couldn't possibly hold everything that someone is saying without having to take copious notes. So for me, it was, and then here's the written hardcover, and you go down and you analyze it, all that, and then you get to play with it, which I learned how to do much later. But, absolutely. I agree with that 100%.
You know, it's interesting. The blend of the two is that in our last Torah study, those who have listened to it know that I called in on a cell phone. I was driving in a car.
Yes.
I was talking on a cell phone driving in a car. I had nothing in front of me. And as you would go through a statement, well, a statement that we've covered before, so I mean it's unfair in the sense that I'm really familiar with it because not only did I translate it and wrote about it, but we've devoted a number of shows about it. But as we talked about it, every nuance of every word remained clear in my mind. I could talk to you about the stems, the moods, the conjugations of each word. Every word that you wrote was visually imprinted on my mind, and all of the implications of it, so that we could have an active conversation. You know, I'm not a very good just shut up and listen sort of guy. I like to respond and underscore certain things, and you know, maybe that's irritating, but it's kind of the style that I have. And,
no, probably irritating y'all more than y'all irritating.
No, that's not the case. But it was amazing how, after a while, you come to own the material. I mean, own the material. I don't want to make certainly the words not mine. But it's incorporated in me, you know. It's part of me. It's made this imprint in me, and so it doesn't matter if you're reading it or sitting on a cell phone and as driving with a family. In fact, I even put it on the speaker phone because this family is also searching to know. Yeah, I put it on the speaker phone so that they could hear what you were saying, not just what I was saying. You know, imagine doing that, though, and talking technically about each of these Hebrew words.
That would seem like a tough task, but it
isn't with you.
Easier for me, and you've kind of gotten it down to a fine art.
But it's easy for us only because we're so comfortable.
Mm-hmm.
And I think a lot of it, Kirk, is that there isn't anything that we read that doesn't reinforce or affirm something we've come to know. All the pieces fit together. It's the same story.
Well, the point last Friday was right down to the letter.
Right down to the letter.
I mean, even the
literally to the letter.
Words that are not supposed to be translated, they still say, they tell you exactly what a friend of ours called me after yesterday.
Uh-huh.
And he said, he was listening to the show, and he said about the Aleph Tal. And
mm-hmm.
What struck out in him was exactly what I was trying to convey a little bit, was that he said, and here it's implied that the next word being Shamar, studied not only the words and the sentences and everything, but also studied, I take this to mean, study the daring letters.
Right.
That's why you don't change, that's why you need the pictographs, not
right.
A lot of Hebrew writing, because
correct.
You have from Aleph to Tau is the whole alphabet, and then I started thinking about Dode writing, you know, 119 Psalms.
Mm-hmm.
Every letter.
Right. One at a time in alphabetical order.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And the pictures, unlike any language really
yes.
ever conceived, this one has real meaning in the words. I mean, in the letters.
Yes.
As well, so it's not a waste of time just to go do the letters. I'm not doing it just for kicks. There's really stuff, extra stuff there.
Yeah. So. This is the thing that when you want to know is something of man or something of God.
Mm-hmm.
And I shared it as a show or two ago that the things of man, the closer you look, the more flawed they become. And the things of God, the closer you look, the more inspired, the more beautiful, the more profound they are. The thing about Hebrew is that if you look at the detail of the shapes and even the direction of the pictographic alphabet,
right,
and how they're placed within the words and how they relate to one another and how the same symbol can have a positive or negative implication depending on which direction the letter is facing and what's the letter that it is facing or that it's turned away from.
Right.
Is those details, are they jots, the yods and the tittles, the strokes in the smallest letter, that make such a profound difference in our understanding. But it doesn't end there. It's always been my favorite thing, Kirk, to study the details and see how the details come together and relate to form the big picture.
Right.
So what you're talking about here is near and dear to me. It's the thing I enjoy most. I want to focus on the details, connect them in such a way that I can see the big picture. In Hebrew, while the details are better equipped to do that than anything I have ever been exposed to, I'm actually more impressed with the big picture.
Of course.
And the big picture...
I just like to be reinforced. I mean,
yes.
For me, it's everywhere you turn, anything you turn over, there it is again.
Yeah, and the big picture here, I don't mean as the message.
Mm-hmm.
I mean as the medium, the big picture and the language itself. To have a language that is like light, where it just exists in truth, where past, present, and future coalesce.
Yeah.
What other language would be written like that so that the words themselves reflect the nature of the author?
Who puts light right in the middle of the word Torah?
Right. But yet it's there. Who puts the covenant right in the midst of their name?
Mm-hmm.
But Yahweh did.
Yeah.
Who would create a language that is 100% consistent with his nature?
Yeah.
Who would create a language where there is a relationship between the subject and an object with every verb, establishing the nuances of the action as it relates to the subject and the object. But isn't that perfect for a relationship?
Well, yeah, it's amazing when you do it. You just go, wow. This is really...
Yeah. Yes. Who would create a language where there are no tenses, which means it's always true, like light, but it has conjugations, and because it is a language to present a relationship, there's only two conjugations, a completed action and an ongoing action.
Right.
Because what is relationships about? Aren't relationships about action?
Sure.
Yeah, there's only two conjugations,
right?
Completed action and ongoing action. And he weaves those two together so ideally so that you come to realize that the whole purpose of the witness is to perfect the imperfect.
Yeah.
And that's why the two conjugations are the perfect and the imperfect. And then to have a language... I've never heard of this before. You ever heard of a language that has moods? And that the moods in Hebrew almost universally address volition? Because a relationship requires free will.
Amazing.
So those are the three elements of Hebrew grammar. You know, they're all relationships. So the big picture relative to the language, to me, is as inspiring as are the insights that can be gleaned from the details. I even like, and I at one time, Kirk, I was frustrated by this because there are so many grammatically correct writers and scholars that turn their nose at a sentence that begins with an or but or while or so.
Yes.
And yet, the vast preponderance of Yahweh's sentences begin with wall. The overwhelming preponderance. And so I realized after a while that the wall was really punctuation. End of the last sentence, start of the new sentence. Not always, but typically that. But better than the period, the wall says, and this too. In addition to that, this is also true. This is going to build on that. If you read the next sentence, you're going to increase what you were able to understand in the previous one, and it's going to augment your understanding. That's what the law does. And so rather than leave it out because Rebbetarians don't like to begin a sentence with and or then or the, you know, or well, then while or so words, or but,
yeah.
It's there for a reason.
Mm-hmm.
It's to show the connection and the augmentation, the advancement of the story. So there's even little things like that that mean something to me. You know, in English, you don't know that it's a question until you look at the mark at the end of the sentence.
Mm-hmm.
And the tone and the perspective of asking a question is very different than the tone and approach to making a statement. So, you know, why did you do that? Why did you do that? You know, they're completely different. But in Hebrew, the interrogatory, the question, is the first word of the sentence. Right from the beginning, you say, oh, this is a question. This is a who, what, why, when, or where question.
Mm-hmm.
Be advised, this is a question. It starts you off in the right mindset. At one time, Kirk, I was somewhat bothered by the fact that there's so many Hebrew words that can be translated with a light and dark side. Anah is a great example. It's used in four of the seven Moed Mikre. And the primary meaning of Anah is to answer and respond. Well, isn't that the perfect word in the midst of an invitation? If the Creator God of the universe is going to give you an invitation to attend a party, wouldn't you expect somewhere in there that maybe you ought to think about responding mm-hmm. and answering the invitation?
Mm-hmm.
And so that's why Anah is there. But Anah can also mean to afflict.
Yeah.
That's its fifth or sixth meaning.
And religious stones.
Right. And so in that regard, if you answer and respond to Yahweh's invitation, you won't be afflicted. If you disregard his invitation,
you will.
You will.
Isn't that beautiful?
Isn't that beautiful? And beyond that, if God is actually saying that I was afflicted, so you won't be. On matzah, which is the first time it comes up, he was anah. On matzah and on Pesach, so we wouldn't be. I mean, so you take something that now it takes a little extra thought. You have to tell people, honestly, this can go either way, and the context is what is driving it. Why would these words exist with a darkened like side? Well, let's look at Yare. Yare is a perfect example. Yare is equally comfortable being translated fear or revere.
All right.
Being afraid or respect? Can you respect somebody you're afraid of?
What the question really becomes is, if you're afraid, can you revere or can you love someone? No.
Well, I don't think you can respect somebody you're afraid of.
Power. I mean, that sort of thing.
Yeah.
No.
If somebody is going to intimidate you, they cannot earn your respect. If somebody is going to earn your respect, it's through logic or reason or past behavior or their prior support or something they did that was worthwhile. If they're instilling fear,
yeah.
It's because they couldn't instill respect.
That's more point. Yeah, exactly.
But Yari can be both ways. So you have to look at the sentence and who is speaking to realize, should I respect Yahweh or fear him? But it goes deeper than that. If you don't respect him, there'll be a day you will fear him.
You will fear him. So why is every translator, almost 90% of the time, is always fear?
Oh, that's an easy one. That's an easy one.
Yeah.
Why do you think that they choose fear the Lord?
Fear the Lord. Well, number one, they choose two words. Lord, too, is.
Yeah, I know. That's they've chosen that. They replaced Yahweh's name with Lord, and then they say fear the Lord. Why do you think they have made those two changes?
Because there's no reason for them to exist.
Yeah, the whole thing is, if you're afraid of a Lord type of a God, they can control you. They can manipulate you. Have you ever read Machiavelli's The Prince?
I've read excerpts, but I didn't read the whole thing.
Yeah. And Machiavelli's The Prince, it's always thought to be the book that tells you the ends justify the means. Mm-hmm. And while it doesn't actually say that, it sort of infers it chapter. But the chapter that's inferring that is really the core of the book.
Mm-hmm.
What it says is that as the rich and empowered in Florence seek to control the world through becoming Pope of the Roman Catholic Church, that they have two options to influence and control the masses. One is to love them unconditionally and for them to see your devotion and kindness and love and support. And the other is to terrorize them.
Yes. Yeah,
to know that if they step out of line, they won't just be killed, but they will be killed in a horrific and public way. And to treat those who would oppose you mercilessly.
Mm-hmm.
And Machiavelli said, one is almost impossible, and it's not enduring. The other is extraordinarily easy, and it always prevails.
Oh, what did Muhammad say? I am empowered by fear or something.
Yeah, I've been made victorious through terror.
Victorious by fear, yeah.
Yeah, mm-hmm.
So everybody picks up the same cue.
Yep, and that's was Machiavelli's conclusion. That's why he told the popes that he wrote and the empowered in Florence, terrorize people. And if you terrorize people, you will gain absolute control. So the ends... The means is justified by the ends. Use terror for the reason that you will be in absolute control. But that's a great example of a Hebrew word that can go either way, because depending on how you approach Yahweh as Father or Lord determines whether or not you're going to respect and revere Him or fear Him. But it's awfully easy to control people if God is fearsome and scary. Right?
Yeah. Well, written different ways, but I mean, written the same way, but pronounced a different way. You get 10 little words like Edon and Adon. And
right.
Know.
Right. What a wonderful example. Yeah. Yeah. And what Kirk is talking about here is that throughout the Torah, you have Aleph, Daleth, Nun, as Edon. And Edon is the upright pillar of the tabernacle. It's what enlarges it, makes it secure. The tabernacle is where God's children are protected from the elements and get to celebrate their relationship with Yahweh. It's the place where Yahweh's testimony is revealed. And the great parties are held, and the family is loved and nourished and protected. And so it's the upright pillar of that tabernacle represents Yahusha, who stood up for us so we could stand with Him. And that's Edon. But the same three letters can also be vocalized Adon. And Adon is Lord. It's not the primary word, Hebrew word for Lord. The primary Hebrew word for Lord is Baal, yeah. But it's a secondary Hebrew word for Lord. And it's for the most part, when it's used in the Torah, Prophets, and Psalms, it is used of men. You know, people will see, like today we say, sir.
Sure.
Then they said, my lord. Mm-hmm. And they didn't have a sir. So if somebody was addressing King David, they would, call him my lord as opposed to calling him sir.
Yeah.
You know, because it's an elevated title. Yeah, it was the Adon was a way of denoting respect as saying you know, sir, I respect your position here.
Mm-hmm.
That's what it represented. It did not mean Lord, as Baal means Lord, as owner, one who possesses, one who controls.
You're not property of.
Right, not the property of. And so there's a real distinction between the two, and yet that distinction is lost because 7,000 times in the Torah, Prophets, and Psalms, these quote-unquote translators have replaced Yahweh's name with Lord.
I hate these guys.
Yeah, it's Yahweh made it really clear.
Grows every year. The boy
Yeah, dimwits. Yeah, and of course the third statement written in stone says, "If you do that, I will not forgive you."
I won't forgive you.
There is no forgiveness if you do that. Don't do that.
Continue. It's over.
Yeah, I'm warning you. In fact, even that's the only one of the 10 statements that's repeated twice.
Mm-hmm.
You notice that he says it. If you belittle or negate the value of my name, I will not forgive you. And then he says it again. I will not forgive you if you negate or belittle my name, Yahweh.
Yeah. And it's so obvious.
Yes. And yet they do it. Well, let's turn to some words. This will be Bereshit 15:1. It's the next encounter between Abram and Yahweh. It begins with a car, after, following, and pertaining to, while pursuing, these conversations, the bottom. I want to stop there for a moment, and Kirk, just ask you a question. Did the recording of these conversations do anything for Abraham?
No, sir, not at all.
They were of no benefit whatsoever to Abraham, were they?
No, most everything he would not have realized in his lifetime, so...
Now, so with Abraham, these conversations took place, but the fact that they're recorded for us, when were they written down for us?
When he dictated them to Moshe.
Right. So that was right around 1450 BCE, whereas the conversations took place with between Yahweh and Abraham right around 2050-ish BCE.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so we're dealing with, what, 550 years, almost 600, in fact, pretty close to 600 years.
Yeah, closer to six.
Yeah. So these, the very first thing you need to know is that this was not written down for the benefit of Abraham.
It is.
It's us. You know, the story of Noah and the ark isn't told for the benefit of Noah and his family.
No, they know the story.
Right. The story of what happened in the Garden of Eden, the Gan Eden, is not told for the benefit of Adam or Chawa.
No.
It's only told for our benefit. The creation account where Yahweh details the order he did things and why he did things and how he did things isn't written there for the benefit of Yahweh.
No.
Been there, done that. It's all shared for our benefit and only for our benefit.
Mm-hmm.
And if you don't look at this presentation of the conversations between Abraham and Yahweh as God's way of telling us in a very real and tangible and personal manner how he, Abraham, and Yahweh engaged in this relationship, what its terms and conditions were, what its benefits were, and therefore how we, because God is consistent and he does not change, how we ourselves can capitalize on this relationship and engage with him, then you've missed the entire purpose of it.
Mm-hmm.
So very little more important than understanding that. After these conversations, Devarim, communications and statements, recorded messages and accounts. The word. You know, interesting. You've got Devarim, which is the plural of Devar, followed by Devar. The word of Yahweh came to exist, Haya. And it's interesting now, you've got the juxtaposition of Devarim and Devar, conversations and the word, Yahweh with Haya. It's Yahweh Haya. Is there a connection between Yahweh and Haya?
Well, the letters.
How about three of the four letters in Yahweh's name? How about Haya being the basis of Yahweh's name? Yes. He was, he is, he will be.
And when you think he exists forever, and no matter which direction you're going, right. It spells the same thing. It just goes, yeah, it's pretty, yes. Pretty poignant.
After these conversations, the word of Yahweh came to exist as God unto, that's El, God unto Abram, the uplifting father, in the form of a personal, visual, and illuminating manifestation which could be seen and experienced. Oh, my goodness.
Mm-hmm.
Bah, ha, meshachis. Wow. You want to see God? What did he just tell you? If you, Kirk, want to look directly at God at this moment, what should you do?
Read his words.
There he is. He just told you that the word of Yahweh came to exist as a visual, tangible revelation, as an enlightening communication which could be beheld and visualized as a window or aperture constructed for the purpose of flooding an area with light.
Mm-hmm. Just a side note.
Yes. And I'm sorry for laughing here, but that is just so profound, and I know that it's missed by almost everyone. And it's so important and so profound. Go ahead.
No, I was just on the, I lost my train of thought there. Never mind.
Okay. Well, the very basis... Yeah, I'm sorry. I have this as a bad habit of getting excited over such things. Machezek is based on Shazah.
Yes.
Shazah means to see and perceive.
Oh, that was my point. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah, to behold and intelligently discern. So what he's saying is that by looking at Yahweh's word, we can see and perceive. We can behold and intelligently discern everything that's important to know about Yahweh.
Well, the question I was going to ask you
mm-hmm.
was, there was a debate when I was looking through all this. The question of it being a material visitation
mm-hmm.
versus some vision in a dream or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
All the Christian people won't do that. All the Christian things that I found, most all of them, rather not all, but most of them, they declare that it is not a personal visitation, a material being there, someone who could actually touch or encounter or stand before you. And I said, well, why are they doing that? And finally I found you can go to, Jensen's and a bunch of others. Finally they say, no, that's not. It's supposed to be a real, he's talking about a real visitation here with a human-like person or a material being there in front of him. And I kept trying to think to myself, well, why the Christians don't want that to happen? To be, is it just because that's
because then they're not dealing with the advent as a little baby coming into the world as a little baby that's dependent on the Mother of God and the Queen of Heaven that they can control and manipulate. Aw, isn't he cute? Or it eliminates their second coming, doesn't it?
Yeah. Then you have more than two.
Then how in the world could you have a new and better and improved, more friendly God in Jesus Christ if the Word became flesh and was visualized by Abraham 2,000 years earlier?
I mean, are they that shallow? I mean,
yes, obviously.
Well, obviously,
they're that shallow.
Myself, I say, right. What?
Yeah. Yeah, that's the most profound. Well, I think the most profound part of this is our view of Yahweh is vastly superior to those that saw him as the column of light or the burning top of Mount Chorib.
That's showing
that our view of Yahweh is even better than the view that Moshe had.
Mm-hmm.
That our view of Yahweh is even better. At least we are given the opportunity to have a clearer, more complete understanding and visualization of who Yahweh is than even Dote had, than any one of the prophets. Far better than the 12 disciples. No one in human history has had the opportunity to see Yahweh as clearly
different lights, yeah,
as we do today. Because of the combination of knowledge, the tools that help define these words, the access to the original alphabet, all of it gives us a much better, clearer picture of who Yahweh is than has ever been available before. I think that's the most profound thing. The second most profound thing is, how in the world could you have a religion based upon the advent of a Christmas time baby and a second coming when he returns, if he manifests himself tangibly, visibly, to Abraham to establish the covenant?
Let me ask you further on the same sentence.
Mm-hmm.
When he says Yahweh again, why would he tell him not to be afraid if it was just some little dream? He had to
Correct.
Be there in front of him that really
right. Yeah, doesn't that right? Doesn't that cement it?
So it's not logical to say Yahweh then,
yeah,
unless he was there materially.
Right. Now my guess is that there was no reason at that point for Yahweh to dial himself down such that he just appeared as a regular old guy.
Mm-hmm.
You know, my guess is that Yahweh at that point, we were told on who knows what actually happened because it's in the Christian New Testament and it's translated from Hebrew to Greek and very poorly maintained with what they call the experience of the Mount of Transfiguration, where Yahusha became light. By the way, people can't figure that out. Maybe he returned that way. Maybe he really is that.
Yeah.
Maybe it's a real clue about why your physical nature is a liability. Maybe there's some real insights to say, the God who inspired the Torah prophets and Psalms may also be light.
Yeah.
Maybe they're one and the same. Think about that. Right.
Otherwise, you can't go on the field trips.
Right. So I guess you're a handsome guy, an imposing figure on the human stage. But Kirk, if you walked up to me, would you ever have to say, "Hey, Greg, don't be afraid"?
No. So my point, yeah. So I'm reading it right. I just think they're saying I made a little note. I mean, why does he have to say that if the King James is type of lexicons are right and it's not a physical thing, then what does he have to, why would he be so right? Why would he might be so right?
Right. It implies two things. You've got to think it through. It implies two things. That A, it was a physical thing that he saw.
Yes.
Now that's assuming that you could also include light as a physical phenomenon, but all we really see is light. So let's include light as the thing he saw, since everything we see is really the light that is reflected off of it. Yes, or the light that's emanating from it. So let's include light here. He had to be less dialed down than he was, as simply Yahusha walking amongst the crowds. Yahusha never had to tell the crowd, "Hey, man, the Sermon on the Mount, we're going to begin this sermon. First thing I want you to know is don't be afraid."
Yeah. No, never had to say that.
Okay. So there's something different going on here, isn't there?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Now I want to extrapolate that on a moment. Now, this is purely extrapolation. Just came into my little old puny brain, and it's strictly extrapolation.
Yeah.
If you're going to say that the word of Yahweh came to exist as a visual illuminating manifestation, which could be seen and experienced, and then do not be awed or afraid, might we correctly conclude that he came to Abram as light? As a manifestation of light, and so he did not look like your average Joe that he had met on the road to Yisrael.
I'm right there on the same page.
And maybe is that why Meshachet speaks of a revelation of enlightening communication.
Mm-hmm.
As a window which lets light in, or an aperture
Yes.
Constructed for the purpose of flooding an area with light?
Mm-hmm.
Did you think that maybe there's a chance that this is the underfooting of the concept of what occurred on the Mount of Transfiguration?
That would be the dot I would connect.
That's the dot that I would connect to. That's my my take on this as well. And I personally, I think that is the third most important insight from this. I still think the most important is that you want to see as clearly, as distinctly as he can be seen, look at his words. The second is it completely negates the concept of Christianity. And the third, it underscores his nature as light. Yeah. Now that does end with, so after these conversations, the word of Yahweh came to exist as God unto Abram in the form of a personal, visual, and illuminating manifestation which could be seen and experienced. To say, La Amar, do not be awed. Al Yare. Do not be frightened, do not be intimidated, and do not worship me, nor feel any anxiety. Abraham.
Well, that's a totally different concept.
Now, what's so powerful about that
mm-hmm.
is that here is now the third person over the course of history that we have a detailed insight into Yahweh's relationship with.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the first, it was Adam, and we're walking in the garden together, and Yahweh is so into Adam, he says, you know what I think this guy's going to like? I think what he's going to really like is woman. I'm going to create a woman, and he's going to really like woman.
Yeah.
Isn't that cool?
Yeah.
You know? You know, I'm a straight guy. I think the design of woman is really cool. So here's Yahweh saying, you know, we're gonna go name the animals. We're gonna look at life, and we're gonna take a walk through this beautiful, perfect garden, and we're gonna spend quality time together. And oh, by in addition to that,
wait till you see this, pal.
I'm gonna create a woman. Yowza.
Yep.
What a god. Now, there's a best friend for you, right? All right. Excuse me giggling, but it just dawned on me. What a deal.
What a deal.
What a deal. Okay. And, you know, and he didn't present either of them all covered up. You know, I made some differences here. You may want to explore these differences.
Pay attention here.
She's not the same as you.
Oh.
Okay, well, we'll get back to the PG version.
Oh.
You know, I'm laughing because I really think it is so cool that God would do this for us. I do. I think it's cool. It shows his friendly, approachable, fun-loving nature. So here we have his next experience. He comes and he introduces himself to Noah. They had a working relationship. I mean, can you imagine having a more of a working relationship than Yahweh had with Noah? Hey, dude. You might want to build a boat. I want you to build this. Now, yeah, I want you to choose to do it, but they had a working relationship. So Adam and Yahweh had a playful relationship, didn't they?
Yeah.
It was strictly playful.
Yeah.
And this next one, Noach and Yahweh, they had a working relationship.
Very interesting.
Yeah, really. Isn't that interesting?
It's playful. Then.
Yeah, it never dawned on me to put it in those terms either. So, here...
Sit down. You have to revise your book, of course.
You know, one of the things I gave up on is if I added the thoughts that we've come to in these programs to the chapters...
You'll have 20.
Then what's the purpose of these audio programs?
Yeah, you've got to have some good stuff in the show.
Right. And now, look at this relationship. This relationship is to make it enduring, to make the process to which we engage in this relationship become knowable, understandable, eternal.
Yeah, and for everyone.
Yeah.
Pays attention.
This is the method of codifying that relationship. I have a playful relationship. I have a works-related working relationship. And now I'm going to show you the enduring nature of this relationship. I'm going to lay it all out for you in case you missed it. Here are the benefits. Here are the requirements. I'll lay it all out for you so that you, too, can engage in the same relationship. So the whole discussion with Abraham is specifically designed so that we, too, would know how to capitalize on it and what to expect from it. What God wants from us and what he's offering in return makes this the single most important conversation of all time.
Yeah. That's God loving you.
Yeah. Now, Kirk, I have a lot of confessions that I make along the way and say, you know, my view here is really extreme. And, you know, you may not want to have the same view that I have. And if you have a different one, I'm certainly fine with that. I'm not going to argue with you. I'm just telling you what mine is. And I'm warning you in advance that mine is at the extreme of acceptable. Yeah, was my friend. We're buds. He's my dad. He's the dad I really never knew. I find him very approachable. I find him negotiable. I find him laughable at times. I find him to be brilliant and inspiring, but ultimately comfortable to be around. I understand that, well, I can't really fully appreciate what the difference between seven-dimensional and little me and, fluffy and flawed and in three dimensions. I get that. I get the difference in our capability and intellect. Okay. But the way that he approaches us, and therefore I'm going to make this personal, me, yeah, negates all of that. He's just friendly. He's approachable. He's welcoming. He's not boastful. He's not scary. Yeah, he has every reason to boast. But he doesn't.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, creator of the universe.
Right.
Plus in every dimension.
Right, right. He has every right to impose whatever he wants to impose, but he doesn't. He makes knowing him fun. He makes approaching him fun. He makes being in his presence comfortable.
I stopped being afraid of Yahweh 2 weeks into reading Yada Yah. When it finally dawned on me, what you're saying is absolutely what he's saying.
Yeah. And I don't know why, Kirk, but I started there. And I don't know why I started there, but I just sense that that's what he wanted. And now I've lived it.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I'm sure that there is justification and an appropriateness with even those in the covenant taking a different view and wanting to experience the chasm of difference between us mere mortals and Yahweh.
Mm-hmm.
And to never really totally relax and is comfortable in his presence. You know, I've gotten to the point where I actually relax even when I'm doing stuff that I know isn't conducive to our relationship. Because
mm-hmm.
I think of his buddy, his son, Dode, David, yeah, and recognize how much stuff old David did. And Yahweh doesn't have high expectations from us. You know, if occasionally we stumble upon a nugget and celebrate it and share it, that's really good, and he's going to enjoy that part. And it's kind of what you want in a spouse, is someone that will minimize or overlook the negative stuff and really enjoy the positive and make a really big deal of the positive and make not hardly even care about the negative.
Yeah.
And because he does that, there aren't moments of even feeling uncomfortable or remorse. I'm just comfortable.
Mm-hmm.
I can be me, and he's okay with that.
I don't think that's the extreme.
No, well, I certainly don't think so, but I think it's appropriate to share it.
Yeah, it's volitional. You can do what you want, but that's...